everything under the sun is a waste of time. Because in the end, you're going to die, and everything you've ever accomplished is going to die. Bertrand Russell said the almost the identical thing. In fact, I quoted in my debate with Michael Martin. Read you a quote from Bertrand Russell. Okay, it's on page 12, bottom of page 12. He wrote this in Why I'm Not a Christian, it's a collection of his essays. That man is the product of causes which had no provision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Okay, he's basically arguing that we are accidents, humans are accidents, that we're going to die, we're going to cease to exist, and someday the universe is going to die, and everything we've ever accomplished will die with it. And then he says that those who agree with him should build their lives and their belief system upon this firm foundation of unyielding despair. My question is, why? Okay? And so, you know, does your worldview provide meaning in life? And I don't think atheism does. Of course, Solomon ends the book of Ecclesiastes that when he considers everything, he talks about God put eternity in our hearts. So, life is really not temporary. There are eternal issues involved. We are to exist eternally. It's either going to be eternal life or eternal death. And so basically his conclusion was to fear God and to obey his commands because God's going to bring everything, even the thoughts, even our thoughts, into judgment. And so he starts out with the big building projects are meaningless under the sun if you don't put God in the equation. And then at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, he comes to the conclusion even the tiny things like our thoughts have eternal value because there is a God. So once you put God in the equation, even the little things take on eternal significance. But like Solomon said, you take God out of the equation and it's nothing but futility. It's nothing but vanity. And so under experiential relevance, you know, you have moral category, meaning. Livability. You know, this is all under the third in our series of tests of worldviews. You know, if somebody has a worldview and they can't live consistently with it, is it really worth it? You know, shouldn't it, maybe it's time to trash your worldview and get another one. And Francis Schaeffer went to town on this about how John Cage, he was an existentialist. He believed there was no God, that we got here by chance, that we live in a chance universe, okay? And so he was a musician. He could, you know, classical musician, could, tremendous amount of talent and training, yet he decided that since everything got here by chance, there's no distinction between music and non-music. So what he would do, he would flip a coin to determine what his next note would be. Okay, so he would write compositions based totally on chance. Okay, and so then when he would perform this, people would boo him. They would throw lettuce at him and tomatoes at him, and then there'd be one or two existentialists in the audience who would, you know, stand up applauding with a tear running down their cheek or whatever. But Francis Schaeffer pointed out that John Cage acknowledged he could not apply his views of a chance universe to his favorite hobby, which was the eating of mushrooms, because he had to draw the distinction between poisonous mushrooms, which would kill Cage, and non-poisonous mushrooms, which would delight Cage. And so when it came down to his favorite hobby, he could not live consistently with his worldview. Okay? So, you know, it's the old cliche, actions speak louder than words. So, if you can't live consistently with your worldview, why should I even give you a worldview the time of day? And so, I would see those as the three tests of a worldview. Is it internally consistent? You know, is it non-contradictory? Does it have explanatory power? Okay? And then number three, is it experientially relevant? And those are areas. You could, you know, experiential relevance, you could even just classify that as livability. You know, you could, they're almost synonymous there, so. Okay, any questions or comments at this point? Okay, if you turn the page over, what we want to do right now is just give a brief definition of each of the worldviews that we're going to discuss in this course. And theism, we're going to focus on Christian theism. We may have enough time to maybe show the differences between Christian theism and Islamic and Jewish theism. Then again, we may not have time, so we'll try to spend a little bit of time on that. But theism is basically the existence of a personal God. Technically, we're talking about monotheism, the belief in one personal God. Now, two important words, well, we'll talk about it later, so you don't need to write it down right now, but two important words that come to play with theism are immanence and transcendence. Transcendence, we mean that God is separate from the universe, separate from his creation, and immanence, that he is involved with his creation. And in fact, let me write them down. Immanence and transcendence. Immanence, God is involved with his creation. I mean, he sustains it in existence. He keeps it in existence. Okay? Immanence, God can... In Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, God can intervene and perform miracles. Okay, he is immanent. But he's also transcendent. God is not equated with his creation. He's not equated with the universe like he is with pantheism. He's separate from the universe. Okay? And not only is he separate from the universe, but he transcends the universe. He's above the universe, not the... as far as location, but as far as he goes beyond the realm of the senses, of the physical universe. Okay? You know, it's like each person has a thirst for something more, a thirst for transcendence. And I think that's a thirst that God placed within our hearts. God draws us to Himself. So, in theism, God is both immanent and transcendent. Now, in theism, God is transcendent, but He's not immanent. Theism is a God who created the universe and then left it alone. God cannot perform miracles. He cannot or does not perform miracles. Okay? So deism, God created the universe and then left it alone. He created the universe and left it alone. He doesn't intervene. He doesn't perform miracles. So is God transcendent? Yes, He's transcendent in deism because He's separate from the universe. But He's so separate that there's no immanence whatsoever. He doesn't get involved with it at all. It's kind of like He set the laws of nature in motion and then He just left them alone. So He's not even sustaining the universe. He created His self-sustaining universe and then just left it on its own, doesn't intervene, doesn't perform miracles. And so deists like Thomas Jefferson did not believe that Jesus was God incarnate, did not believe that the Bible was the inerrant word of God, did not believe that these miracles had really occurred. Okay? And it's really, deism is not so much the product of bad theology as it is the product of really bad science. Ancient people used to think earthquakes was, you know, the gods got angry. Ground rumbled. But when scientists started figuring out what earthquakes, the physical causes for earthquakes, then they came to the conclusion that, you know what, given enough time, we're going to figure out the physical causes, the natural causes for everything. So it's the assumption that there are no supernatural causes. There are no miracles. And so we'll talk a little bit about deism. Polytheism. Polytheism is the belief that there are many gods. Polytheism, the belief that there are many gods. Dualism, that's the belief that there are two gods. Usually it's an all-good God and an all-evil God. It tries to explain the problem of evil by saying that evil is co-eternal with good. Okay? But we'll talk about some of the problems with that later on. Finite Godism. Acknowledges the existence of God, but He's limited. How many people here have heard of Rabbi Harold Kushner? He's a Jewish rabbi, and his 14-year-old son died in a horrible car accident that just devastated him. And so what he did was he changed his theology because of that. He could not accept that God allowed that to occur. And so he believed that God is not all powerful, God's limited in power, and God couldn't have prevented evil and innocent human suffering. So it amazes me that his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, sometimes they're sold, his books, those books are sold in Christian bookstores. And in that book, he says that we should forgive God for the mistakes that He's made, and and that we should help God to fight evil, because without our help, he might lose. And so there's a modern example of finite godism. And we'll talk about some of the problems with that a little later. Panentheism. Now, panentheism is different from pantheism. Look further down the page. There's like Eastern pantheism, New Age pantheism. Panentheism adds an E-N in the middle, okay? And that's important. Because pantheism, if you go down to point H, you know, pantheism is the view that God is everything. God is the universe. Panentheism is like God is in the universe. So basically, panentheism, you know, God is in everything. Basically, the universe is God's body. So for panentheism, the universe is God's body. Really weird, but the panentheist is basically arguing that God is both finite, he's both limited and infinite, unlimited in his basic nature. And we'll talk about that, why that's contradictory, and we'll also talk about how that doesn't really apply to the incarnation of Christ, because Christ had has two natures. But that's panentheism. Atheism is the belief that there is no God. So atheism is the belief there is no God. Atheists are now saying that, like Michael Martin, in one of his books, he refers to atheism as the lack of belief in God. But historically, that has been considered agnosticism. So what it amounts to is that atheism has been so thoroughly defeated in the latter half of the 20th century that most of the leading atheists have evacuated from the atheistic worldview and are now agnostics, who question the existence of God and lack belief in God, but they no longer, at least they no longer claim to believe that they can prove God's non-existence. Okay? So what's happened is this major defeat of atheism has led the leading atheist thinkers to retreat from the atheist camp to go into the agnostic camp, but so as not to let anyone know that they suffered a great loss, they have now redefined atheism as the lack of belief in God. But atheism comes from the Greek word theos and the Greek prefix a, which means no, no God. Traditionally, atheism means no God, the rejection of belief in God, and rather than just the lack of belief. The difference here is like saying if you're walking in the hall and somebody says, "Hey, did you see Dr. Fernandez?" And let's say two of you are walking in the hall somebody walks up and says, "Is Dr. Fernandez here?" And one of you doesn't, you know, one of you don't know that I'm here, and the other one does know it. And so one of you say, "I don't know." And the other one says, "He's here." Or let's say, "I'm not here." Okay? So one says, "I don't know." And the other one says, "He's not here." Okay? "He's not here. There's nobody home." That's atheism. "I don't know." That's agnosticism. But now, guys who are saying "I don't know" are calling themselves atheists. It's just basically, they just don't want to admit that the bold atheism of the early 20th century has been devastated. and they've been pushed into the agnostic corner. But with atheism, it's the belief that there is no God. I don't know how far we're going to be able to break it down with the limited time that we have, but naturalism, there's just five different types of atheism. There's some overlap there. Naturalism, only nature exists. So basically, only matter exists, or only physical things exist. Only the physical universe exists. For Marx, I don't even know any way to put something, sum it up in short words. I would just put down economic determinism and class struggle. Economic determinism and class struggle. I don't know if we'll be able to get into that too much, but economic determinism, basically he believed that there is no God, and that everything is predetermined. The outcome, the future is predetermined, history is predetermined by economic principles. Okay? And now he believed that through revolution we could speed up the evolutionary processes. Okay? So he wanted the proletariat, the working class, to revolt against the business owners, those who own capital, okay, and to overthrow them, and that this would eventually lead, he also was influenced by Hegel. There'd be a thesis, an idea, and the antithesis, a contradiction of that idea, and rather than one being true and the other being false, they would merge, they would synthesize to form the synthesis, a new idea, a new truth. And so you have these different things, whether it's capitalism and socialism being synthesized to eventually produce the classless society, Marxist utopia. So you might want to put in the dialectic, that's the battle between the thesis and the antithesis, although this is a very much Marx held to a misrepresentation and oversimplification of Hegel. But Hegel's dialectic was, Marx took it and came up with dialectical materialism. The dialectic, the synthesizing of contradictions. But materialism, only matter exists. With Hegel, only ideas exist. Hegel was a non-materialist. But you had this class struggle between the working class and the business owners and the owners of capital, and Marx believed profit was evil. So he basically took atheism, evolution, some Hegelian thought, threw it all together, and everything he saw, like with Freud, everything Freud saw had sex in it. Okay, with Marx, everything he saw had economics involved with it. So, any problem out there, you know, even viewed religion in terms of economics. Religion was the opium of the people. What he meant was, religion was the narcotic that keeps us so drugged up that we'll work for our slave masters and won't revolt. It's what keeps us from revolting. But even religion is explained in economic terms. Economics becomes almost the ultimate there. Nihilism, some say nihilism, some say nihilism, I don't know. Nihilism is just that there is no truth, no morality, no meaning. No truth, no morality, no meaning. And that, I think, is the real consistent atheism. I mean, if there's no God, why should the workers revolt? You know, if there's no God, I mean, why waste all the energy? In the end, we're all going to cease to exist anyway. And so the most consistent atheist I've ever read is Friedrich Nietzsche. He was a nihilist, but he couldn't live there. Again, you know, bad worldview, no livability. You can't live consistently with it. So he had an existential bent to him. So to escape his nihilism, he was looking for the supermen, the overmen, to come and through their courage and their will to power to create these hard values that were going to push forward the human evolution of mankind and human progress. I believe Christianity was stifling human progress. But that's a leap of blind faith. So some would classify Nietzsche as a nihilist. Others would classify him as an existentialist. Still others would classify him as a postmodernist. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Secular humanism is kind of a formal belief system that's centered on atheism. Oh yeah, that's right. That's only because I just spaced it out and just went right over. An existentialist. An existentialist believes that you can't find, there is no meaning in life. It's like, here's the rational realm, the realm of reason, and here's the realm of the will and the emotions, all the non-rational aspects of man. In the rational realm, we cannot find meaning in life. We can't find morals, because most existentialists, not all, but most are atheists. There's no God, there's no meaning to life, no truth, no morality. Can't find those things down here. But man desperately needs meaning in life, desperately needs these things. And so the existentialist takes a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm to make my life meaningful. And so for existentialism, things that are important there is an act of the will, you know, to self-actualize yourself, to give yourself meaning, but an act of the will or a leap of blind faith to find meaning in life. Now, who's the author? I don't want to say too much about it because I've heard several books that are with similar titles, and I can't remember if that's just the hyper-Pentecostal out in left field, or if it's the New Ager who is supposedly channeling messages with God. Yeah, yeah. That's basically most pantheists. Most pantheists end up having a polytheistic, neo-pagan bent to them. In other words, the idea that God is the universe, it is just not enough there. This totally unknowable God that transcends rational categories. And so usually the God who is the universe manifests itself in many ways. And so sometimes these ways are gods, so polytheists. So in other words, there are pantheists who are also polytheist at times. And But whatever the case, pantheism automatically, to become a pantheist today is to bring back pagan thought. And that's what we're seeing in the New Age movement. Some call it neo-paganism, neo-spirituality. It's a resurgence of ancient pagan thought. And channeling is nothing but spiritism, where a person tries to contact spirits of the dead. And so the Bible, from a biblical standpoint, it's voluntary demon possession, demonic possession. They don't view it that, the channeler doesn't view it that way, but that's what's going on. You know, Deuteronomy 29:29, the hidden things belong to the Lord, but what God has revealed to us belong to us and to our children. So, you know, God, in His Word, has revealed many truths to us that we should cherish, that we should love, that we should share with our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren on down the line. But there's some knowledge that transcends the world of the senses that God has refrained from revealing to us. And so we can pray to Him, "Dear Lord, please reveal this to me. I need to know, you know, what you want me to do for a career or whatever, you know, whatever it is. Or reveal to me, you know, that James is getting married." You know, I'm sure his prayer for years, like every Christian bachelor, was, "Lord, reveal to me the perfect lady for me to marry," and stuff like that. It was kind of like most Christian bachelors, it's kind of the number one thing on their agenda. Number one, find a godly wife. Number two, serve God. And it's kind of like, you know, your Christian brothers would come alongside you and say, "Hey, man, you got to start serving God." And it's like, "Oh, I will, man. Believe me. Once I find that godly wife, I'm gonna serve God." But now what was I talking about? That somebody help me here. Secular humanism, secular humanism, pantheism.
Started off with conversation.
Just trying to find knowledge that we cannot find through the world of the senses. The only place God says to go is Him. But if God says no, I'm not going to tell you. Okay, King Saul wants to find out the battle with the Philistines tomorrow. Who's going to win? So he goes to God. God is quiet. God doesn't give him an answer. So then he goes to the witch of Endor and tries to conjure up the spirit of Samuel the prophet. So that's what's happening here. People are going into the world of the occult, the hidden, the secret arts, and they're bringing back pagan practices, trying to communicate with the dead, trying to find supernatural knowledge that God has chosen to keep from us. And so it's really nothing new. It's just demon possession. Now, so there's two possibilities there. We know it's not from God. So either the guy, like J. Vernon McGee used to say, had too much pepperoni pizza the night before, and it's just indigestion, and the guy's just coming up with the stuff himself. Or number two, it's not a fraud. This is for real. There is a spirit entity speaking through this person. But it's a demon, and the person is being deceived and is deceiving others. So secular. Oh, but existentialism, though, you got the leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm to find meaning in life. Okay, secular humanism, it just tries to make a religion out of atheism. Although Paul Kurtz, I got to meet him. He wrote the foreword. Humanist Manifesto number 2. But his organization, probably the world's largest atheist organization out of Buffalo, New York, they contacted me and had me debate. I was the token theist to be at their atheist conference at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill campus, to debate some young and upcoming atheist, Jeff Lauder. And so I got to meet Michael Martin there. I got to meet Paul Kurtz. And that's where I think they probably signed part of his Humanist Manifesto 2000. But it's an attempt. In 1933, first Humanist Manifesto, which was signed by John Dewey, and you know, many other secular humanists, they openly acknowledge that they said traditional religion is harmful, you know, no deity will save us, we must save ourselves, and then they proposed a secular religion, and they called it a religion. Well, now their argument is that you have to take religion out of the public schools, take religion out of politics. So now these same guys no longer call secular humanism a religion. Whatever the case, 1961 Turcaso versus Watkins Supreme Court decision, secular humanism was defined as a religion. So basically, teaching kids in the public schools that we evolved from apes is as much religion as teaching them that we were created by God. And so what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So, but their strategy has changed. But basically, secular humanism is a belief system or a religion based on atheism. For Eastern pantheism and New Age pantheism, pantheism is the belief that God is the universe. God is the universe. And since man is part of the universe, man is God. Okay? So God is the universe, man is God, and the type of God we're talking about here is impersonal. So God is impersonal or non-personal. God is an it. It's not the Lord be with you, it's Lucas's Star Wars, the Force be with you. Okay? God's got more in common with electricity than he does with a person. By the way, you don't have to have a body to be a person. To be personal, you have to have an intellect, emotions, and a will. Okay? You're a moral being and a rational being. Okay? God loves us. God gives us moral commands. He wants to have a personal relationship with us. God is a personal being. Pantheism says, no, God is an impersonal force. Okay? So I would put that same definition for both. God is the universe. Man is God. God is impersonal. But then I would also draw one distinction between Eastern pantheism and New Age pantheism. Eastern pantheism traditionally has been an otherworldly pantheism, has an otherworldly emphasis, whereas New Age pantheism has a this-worldly emphasis. In other words, Eastern pantheism, the emphasis was on the other world. In other words, future incarnations, future, you know, reincarnation and the hereafter, okay? They're not real concerned about making a big difference. Well, there's some concerns and some strains of Buddhism, but like traditional Hinduism, there's not even a concern. Don't even worry about these starving people. They're just working off their negative karma. If we help alleviate their suffering, then they're going to have to be reincarnated again just to suffer it off. So let's not hold back their escape from the cycle of reincarnation. Just leave them alone. So most hospitals in India are founded either by Christians or by Hindus, who are Hindus in name only. They don't really believe the traditional Hindu belief system. But the focus is on otherworldly. With that, the big problem is neglect. There's not enough concern about this world. After all, physical world's an illusion anyway. But this world, the emphasis of the New Age movement, is even more dangerous. Because they want to bring the New Age here and now. Forget about thinking about reincarnations and stuff. Yeah, that's going to happen, but let's bring the New Age of peace and righteousness to Earth, where we all reach the mega point and man acknowledges that he is God. And by the way, mankind is God, and that sounds so good until you realize they're not talking about individuals. Okay, Christianity, the reason why we believe human life is sacred is because man was created in God's image, okay? The New Age says we have a higher view of humans. Man is not in God's image. Man is God. But when the Christian says man is created in God's image, we're talking about individuals. Individual human life is sacred. The New Ager really only views man's life, you know, individual existence as an illusion. So man's life has value only collectively. So it's like the whole human race is a tree. And they want to enhance the growth of the tree. So what do you do when some of the branches are dead? You cut them off. So in New Age pantheism, with a this-worldly emphasis, you'll have New Age leaders like the late Jacques Cousteau and Barbara Marx Hubbard. Barbara Marx Hubbard, you know, these people, even Ted Turner, for that matter, Mikhail Gorbachev, if you read between the lines, Al Gore, they're calling for a certain percentage of the world's population to be exterminated. Even for that matter, the United Nations is as well. But Barbara Marx Hubbard tells us 1/4 of the world's population is what she, because she believes 1/4 of the world acknowledges that man is God, so they're ready for the next stage in the spiritual evolution of mankind. Half of the world's population, neither here nor there, but they're open to that concept. But 1/4 of the world's population, the traditional Christians, traditional Muslims, and traditional Jews will never accept, you know, we hold weird beliefs like there is a God and you're not him, okay? And we have no place at the table of this new world order or this new age, this coming new age. So in New Age pantheism, you cut off the dead branches. And they think they're doing us a favor. We'll just be reincarnated anyway, so whatever. And then there's postmodernism. I mean, a postmodernist is just an existentialist who's... Well, see, the modernism was the belief that... Modernism was the belief that through human reason, man could find all truth and solve all his problems. Okay? Well, the modern project failed so horribly that it has led to postmodernism, that man, that there is no truth, and human reason doesn't work, and even the individual, the rational individual, is gone, and now it's kind of you're a product of your community. And since there is no truth, all that's left are narratives, stories. So each community gathers around a narrative, okay? So I don't know what to put for postmodernism. I mean, I say no truth, okay? No absolute truth, and we are a product of our communities, okay? And we gather around a shared narrative. We gather around a narrative, a story. So you have the gay community, okay? The feminist community, okay? It's the religion of tolerance. It's the new tolerance, okay? Toleration used to mean freedom of religion. You're free to be a Muslim and believe like you do. I'm free to be a Christian. And neither one of us wants the other one locked up if we don't violate any laws. The new tolerance says, no, all religions lead to God, and all behavior is equally okay, but if you say that there's such a thing as sin, and if you say not all religions lead to God, then you're intolerant. And we got to do something about it with you intolerant people. So I don't know if they want to confiscate our property, put us in prison, exterminate us or what, but in the name of tolerance, postmodernism is becoming the most intolerant belief system in man's history.
Is there anything like Baha'i?
Baha'i faith has a big emphasis on tolerance, but they're not so much, they really believe that there is truth. The Baha'i faith is more of a, they're coming at it more from, they're trying to hold out hands to Christians and Jews and Muslims to the theists, but also hold out their hands to the New Agers and the Buddhists and the Hindus. And they're saying, oh, and we all teach the same thing after all. So there's some similarities there. There is a big emphasis on toleration, and they do want this utopian one-world government, one-world society, and we're all going to live together in peace, and it's a denial of man's sinfulness. But they're not really postmodern, but the Baha'i faith, the New Age movement, and the postmodernists do share enough beliefs so that in the future, I think you're going to see a big merging and eventually a one world religion that is going to be, in the end, very intolerant. But at this point, the Baha'i people are really, I mean, they're real nice people, and they don't want to hurt you and all. And whereas the Theosophical Society shares many of the same beliefs, but they would like to see Christians exterminated. And so I think there's going to be like a little evolving of, you know, I think eventually the Baha'i type thought is going to be a thing of the past. It's going to be, let's bring the New Age in, let's bring it in now, and let's do whatever it takes. And if that means getting rid of these theists, so be it.
Did you see the John MacArthur on Larry King?